You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about immigrants in America and the sometimes reluctant role they play in election politics.
First, 100 years ago yesterday, the first wireless telegraphic broadcast from the 9XM studio went out over the air. It was the weather forecast. It's cited as the first regular broadcast from the station that would become WHA, the ancestor of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Randall Davidson joins us now to celebrate this anniversary and to tell us more. He's the director of radio services at UW Oshkosh. He's a Wisconsin Public Radio alum and the unofficial historian of WPR, the author of 9XM Talking. Randall, welcome back to Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's nice to be here.
A familiar voice here. Well, this broadcast that went out 100 years ago was not a voice at all, was it?
No, it was just telegraphic. That was the first technology we had available, and we decided what could we use it for rather than just as a gadget. What can we use it for to benefit people? And they thought, well, let's send the weather forecast out. We got permission to do that, and at 11 o'clock in the morning on the 4th of December, 1916, we started sending out the weather by Morse code.
And we have a recreation of what listeners would have heard. And I repeat, this is not the original audio. Here is a little taste.
Okay, I got
that. A little bit like R2-D2,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a little bit. And the pitch is shifting there, but that's not the important part of the dots and the dashes,
right,
if I remember
right.
My Morse code correctly.
Right.
And I don't.
And that's what people heard, but that's what the radio listeners had back then. That's the only things that were available over the air. But this was mostly a hobbyist phenomenon. People, there were about 500 radios in Wisconsin at that time, radio receiving devices. And people that had them, of course, understood Morse code. And we knew there were 12 radios in Madison at that time. But we thought we'd send this out, and we picked 11 o'clock because it was right after the most popular show of the day. From 10:55 to 11, you could tune into the Navy and get the time. And they used that for synchronizing clocks on ships for navigation. So people would tune in for the time. Jewelers particularly like to do this, so you could offer their actual time for their clients. And then you would dial down to where we are on the dial and get the weather forecast, and then you're listening for the day is pretty much done.
Wow. So you said there were 12 radios that we knew of in Madison. What about statewide? Do we have any idea how big?
About 500 total. And mostly it was a lot of teenagers, hobbyists, farmers tinkering with this. People like to tinker with stuff. If you remember back in the first person on your block that had email, these are probably the same kind of people, the early adopters.
And this is significant. You mentioned the Navy was broadcasting stuff. Scientists were doing stuff. This is really the earliest stages of consumer use of wireless transmission.
There were some other people tinkering with it, but this was kind of a first for kind of to do it, not to raise profile or anything, but just to be a service. Mm-hmm. And that's what kind of drove the thinking here. It wasn't too many years after that we did this. It was right after the enunciation of the Wisconsin idea. And that was kind of percolating around and kind of informing a lot what was happening in the physics department at that time when they owned the radio station.
And it sounds like people picked it up and then wrote it down for other people to see, posted it around town. Do we have actual evidence that that's what people did?
The message included that information. When we'd send the weather forecast out at a certain speed, then we'd send it much slower for people just learning. And then at the end we said, please transcribe this and share it with others. So people would put it at the general store or the co-op or the fire station or a bank downtown. And we know one city, actually, the person receiving it took it to town, took it to the telephone company, and the operator rang the entire circuit and read the forecast to everybody that picked up the phone.
And this was, you know, this first one was December 4th, 1916. This wasn't a one-off, though, was it? They kept doing this weather forecast?
No, this is the beginning of the regular schedule. Monday through Saturday, we did this every day at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Do we know what the weather was that day, December 4th, 100 years ago?
No, but I did get someone contacted me from here, from Wisconsin Public Radio, after I'd left, and there was a listener in England that asked when we gave the weather forecast by voice. We have the record for that, too. We were the first radio station to do it by voice. And they want to know how accurate the weather forecast was. So I had to look up what the weather was on January 3rd, 1921, and see how accurate our forecast was.
Wow.
talking to Randall Davidson about some early consumer radio history here in Wisconsin. Yesterday was the 100th anniversary of the first weather forecast in the form of dots and dashes. It was Morse code. Randall, when did 9XM first turn from dots and dashes and Morse code to voices going out and maybe music going out over the air?
Well, this dots and dashes worked perfectly well. I mean,
we should go back to it. You're saying
no. it went well, and certainly more people back then knew Morse code. There were telegraph operators, there were railroad operators. A lot of people knew Morse code as a percentage of the population. A lot more back then than do now. But we realized right away that this is to be useful for everybody. It's got to be something you can hear. So we have evidence in early 1917 of transmission of music. We have two examples. One, a listener in Madison who was listening for the weather by Morse code had his headphones on and heard music after it, and that surprised him. And he wrote in and did an affidavit for us. And shortly thereafter, might have been only a day or two later, Earl Terry, who was the station manager, he was a physics professor here, he decided to invite a bunch of fellow professors and some deans to his house for what he called the first broadcast. And he got them all gathered around his radio receiving device with the big speaker and called down to the radio station, which was in Science Hall then, and told the student there were all ready, and he played a record. And evidently nobody at the party thought this was any kind of big deal. They were not impressed at all.
But they didn't like the music? They just
didn't think it was, they thought it was some kind of just stunt, and they didn't think he was really impressed with what he was doing, but they didn't seem to see the value of it. And we have evidence from a woman who was at the party, wrote to our manager in 1949, 32 years later, that she was at the party. She remembers the song that was played, Narcissus by Ethelbert Nevin. Hmm. And so in our display case in the lobby here, there's a 1913 Victor recording of Narcissus by Ethelbert Nevin on display to kind of mark that event.
So when did Earl Terry, the professor who you're talking about, when did he kind of get his due that this wasn't just something that was an unimpressive party novelty, but was something pretty cool that he was doing?
He figured it out right away. He figured out that this could be used so much as a force for good, as a force to enrich the lives of people. And even after we started doing voice broadcasting, he kept a really, kind of arm's length kind of distance from people that wanted to use this for commercial purposes. He thought this would be something, it really should remain non-commercial. It should be something to elevate the human condition. And he was a strong believer in that. And he's kind of set the tone early on. He predicted way back when that one day radios would be more common than bathtubs in Wisconsin homes. And by 1940, it was true. There were more radios in Wisconsin than bathtubs.
Now, we heard the Morse code there on that weather forecast, and the pitch was shifting all over. What was it like to listen to music over the airwaves? Was it something similar?
We struggled a lot with music broadcasting. We made our own tubes here. There were no commercially available vacuum tubes for transmission that you could really get that you could count on. So Earl Terry became really good at making tubes and actually became good at blowing glass because of the glass blower that the university had was in a car accident. Couldn't do it for a while. But we found that music tended to waver a little bit. We were inviting students from the physics department to come in to the radio station, particularly at night, if they played an musical instrument, to see how these different instruments sounded. We tried a recording of On Wisconsin, and one night we played that and then tuned something and then played it again and tuned something else and played it again, made another adjustment, and then heard from a listener who was tired of this show. And asked, he offered to buy another record for the station, which they thought was kind of nice. Even then, people felt they had the right to call in and complain. And then we found early on that Hawaiian guitar music seemed to sound the best.
It has lots of bends in it already.
It does already, so yeah. It didn't distort, I guess, as much as anything else.
And it got shut down, it sounds like, during the war, right?
Yep, in 1917, when the U.S. entered World War I, this was enough of a new technology that people were not sure how it might be used against us. And so President Wilson ordered every radio transmitter off the air in the United States. And if you had a radio, you had to dismantle it. You couldn't even have a radio receiving device during the war. And Earl Terry wrote to the federal government and said, can we stay on the air? We've been doing experiments with the Navy. He lost a lot of his staff to the Navy anyway. And we got permission to put the station back on the air, and we were on all through World War I, us and a couple others. There was Westinghouse in Pittsburgh had one going too. But this is one of our claims. We've been on the air continuously when everyone else was off. So we were on during the war, and we got all our experimentation got to the point where we got really good at voice broadcasting by the end of the war.
Randall, I got to mention, you keep referring to we. I know you were not around at this time,
no.
But in the course of A, working here, and then B, writing about it, you really personally identify with the history of this place.
I'm personally invested in this story. It's a terrific story of a really service to the people of Wisconsin and beyond, and of people that really deserve, I think, our thanks. I think Earl Terry never got the thanks during his lifetime for all the work he did to found this place, a tiny little 500-watt AM radio station with no money and no resources and, you know, home-built gear. And look what it's grown into. I mean, dozens and dozens of radio stations and a television network and online services and programming for national distribution. And it's just grown from that tiny, tiny little beginning of sending out the weather and Morse code. It's the story of how the good a single person can do can echo into future generations.
And just briefly, to put a cherry on top of the story, when did this little early transmission become Wisconsin Public Radio?
Well, we became a network of two AM stations in 1932. We added WLBL and Stevens Point. We started sharing programming with them, but they did a lot of their own too. And then from between 47 and 52, we built a network of FM stations around the state. We didn't start using the name Wisconsin Public Radio until 1979. I answered that question this morning for a listener who called into the Green Bay office. So that's when we started using the actual, you know, term Wisconsin Public Radio.
Ah, so great to hear that story, Randall. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thank you for helping to hire me. I don't know how many years ago. I don't want to know, but you were instrumental to that, too.
One of the smarter things I did.
That was Randall Davidson, Director of Radio Services at UW-Oshkosh. He's a Wisconsin Public Radio alum and the author of 9XM Talking, WHA Radio, and the Wisconsin Idea. He was with us to talk about the 100th anniversary of the first broadcast from 9XM.
Coming up, now that the election is all over, we look at immigrants and the role they play in electoral politics in the United States. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.